It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
Okay, so I wanted to test something on you because I've been doing a very informal survey. But I have this new theory. So, okay, I have a problem. I...
Just one?
Yes. This is literally the only thing. Other than this, I am a perfect individual. I like to focus my conversations on a particular topic with a person who is emblematic of that topic to the exclusion of other things. The really problematic way in which this shows up is I frequently have my conversations about race with the very few black people I know. And, like, most of our conversations are about race. And, like, none of my conversations with the white people I know are about race.
Mm.
And that's just weird. But the slightly more harmless version is I'm always talking to Stu about the difference between Brits and Americans.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause he's half and half at this point. And so I like to point out different things. 'Cause I watch a lot of... Excuse me. I just ate a lot of chicken very fast. I watch a lot of British television. I've now found a nice super legal way to do it.
Hmm.
I'm subscribing to BritBox, and so I'm getting a lot of stuff off of that, which is cool. Not as much as I would like, but there's a lot there, so I've been watching things. But am I boring you?
I'm just seeing things that I don't understand where they're going. Never mind.
It's safer not to know.
I see cables going places and ending, and it's like, wait, should that be plugged in? And
this is keeping me alive, damn it.
I'm so sorry.
There's one spare open cable, and everything goes in there when it's needed. The laptop goes in when we're podcasting. The charger goes in when I'm charging the tablet. The shredder goes in when we're shredding.
Okay, that's what...
Yeah, it's the one spot. Anyway, so, I was one recently where I think the U.S. and the U.K., use a word differently, but only sort of.
Okay.
The more I'm thinking about it, the more you're a terrible choice to ask about this, but I'm going to do it anyway. What do you think of when I use the word scheme?
Well, I guess immediately I think of like a plan or a plan, yeah.
Just full stop.
Well, I think I've heard it used in the context of like a floor plan or like a blueprint type of thing. But that's, I don't know why I'm thinking that. I must have seen that in a very specific context. But yeah, just a plan.
Yeah, you're special then. Because literally nobody else does that.
Does what?
Thinks of it that way. That is the literal definition. But it is much more commonly used in something with heavy, underhanded, or criminal overtones. Get-rich-quick scheme. Ponzi scheme. Pyramid scheme.
Oh, well, I mean...
What sort of scheme are you up to?
Sure, but you... Oh, okay, well. I was just going to say, in every one of those examples, you had to qualify it.
Yes. What I'm saying is, for the most part, it comes with that.
So people generally think of it as a negative thing?
I think so.
Oh,
and to the degree that I believe Americans, by and large, think of it as an almost exclusively negative thing.
Oh, wow. No, I...
But recently I have discovered that there are times when British people do not consider it a negative thing. I think largely tied to legitimate financial references. So, like, when somebody says to me a savings and loan scheme, to me that's like... Yeah, they talk you into doing savings and then they run off with your money or something like that. But no, it's legitimately just a plan for a savings and loan situation.
Hmm.
And see, when I run this by Stu, Stu kind of sees both. He's still, there's a certain level for him that is very much the underhanded and the sneaky aspect. But then when I put it with the right words, then he's like, no, that just sounds like a plan. But see, now I don't know, because talking with Trish about it, well, she was slightly confused by some of the context, and so she's like, I don't know what it means in that. But she potentially seemed to have that same thing, where sometimes she saw it without the negative connotation, though generally she did. You, I forgot, are William, so I don't know what I was
thinking. Well, it's like if someone says an evil plot or an evil plan or an evil scheme, I mean, I don't think anyone thinks, well, I don't know. People don't think of the word plot as bad, do they?
No. I think, plan. It can be both, yes. But if I said, I got a scheme going, you want in?
Yeah, that doesn't sound bad immediately. Just in that context, that didn't sound bad.
Wow. To me, it absolutely does.
Really?
Yeah. And again, what sort of scheme are you up to? I'm not saying, tell me the details of your plan. I'm saying, you're doing some nefarious shit, and I want to know what it is.
Now, when you said savings and loan scheme,
yes,
that did have a tinge of bad. But the other,
see, and weirdly, that one doesn't.
The two things you just said, they don't sound bad to me.
All right. Set us straight, people. Go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us how you feel about the word scheme. Because we clearly don't know. And I'm telling you to go to themagicaltalkinghat.com. I should say themagicaltalkinghat.com. I need to specify, because at this point you don't know what you're listening to yet, so it could be anything.
Well, I guess maybe part of this is, from, I don't know, maybe this is something you don't know about me, but I've dealt with a lot of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurial stuff in my life, mm-hmm. and it seems pretty normal for people to refer to their business plan
and
as a scheme.
It's quite possible that in a financial and business sense, it has a much more common usage.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. That's what I'm thinking. And so I've just heard it in that sense, and it just...
So that could be it. It could just be that I'm not enough of a banker.
Well, if you only...
I just don't run into it, and like I ran into... I mean, I wasn't watching financial shows.
Yeah.
They talked about it like it was commonly held, and I...
So, that makes sense to me that if you hear the word scheme always in a criminal sense, you're eventually going to think of it that way, probably.
Well, yeah, I wasn't questioning why this was like this.
No. I'm trying to make a point about the opposite. If you hear it in neutral contexts or in perfectly fine contexts, yeah, you're never going to think of it just as a bad thing.
No, based on my original thesis, I assumed it was because Brits still made use of it in language. In neutral language more than, I mean, like,
but that Americans don't.
Yeah, no. At no point that was sort of why this is interesting to me. It's not, oh, it means two different things. No, it's, I'm confident in an English dictionary and an American dictionary, the definition
are
the same.
Yeah, right. That's right. I got you.
I just thought that the connotation is so overwhelming at this point. But my study is in shambles now, not just because of you, but mostly because of you.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that is recorded before a dead studio audience, which, okay, you're like, oh, it's funny, it's a bunch of corpses. No, that's stupid, that's childish. We
childish.
Hired someone to capture the soul of a film studio from the 60s in Burbank. I mean, it was built in the 60s, but it was eventually demolished. We hired someone to capture its soul in a bottle, and we sit it in front of us, the soul of a dead studio, to be our audience while we're recording.
I think we might have paid too much for it.
Hey, $10 is $10. I'm Tony.
But it could just be an empty jar. That's the problem.
Oh, my God. I should tell you a thing.
I don't know.
I'm
And I'm William, and this is episode 422.
All right. I just today was watching, because now I can watch all the QI I want, and I was watching one, and it was about art stuff, and there's some artist that, some Italian artist, and he pooped in a can and sealed it And these are things. There's like 300 of them, and they're labeled like that. It's like artist's feces or something. But he did this, and I forget because some major gallery like bought one or whatever. Now in the last 10 years, it has gone up 10 times in price. But the thing is, nobody is sure that's what's like. Nobody's gonna open it because then you'd ruin the value. And there's only one person around who, like, worked with him, and he claims, no, it's not real. It's just plaster in there. But, like, nobody can find out.
That's
nobody's willing to spend. I believe at this point they are worth $300,000 each. Nobody's willing to buy that and open it and find out. Especially because what if it really was and you open it? Like, that's terrible. I would hate to know that. But, yeah. So that's weird.
Does that make some kind of interesting point?
As art. I mean, it, theoretically, it's a really heavy-handed, obvious one. Like, people will pay exorbitant money for shit.
In a can. And won't open it.
Because if it's a famous artist, in theory, yeah. Or because they find it so novel. Well, hell, there's a small version of this. A common thing you can buy in gift shops are variations on this idea, dinosaur poop and stuff like this. And sometimes they're meant to be opened and it's just candy inside or something like that. But sometimes it's just a can and it's meant to be like a decoration or whatever. Now, in that, you pay like $8 or whatever, not 300,000. But I just love the idea that like we don't know and we basically won't ever know. Because nobody's willing to open one up.
And then and there's a market for this.
And it also gets into this weird, apparently. Well, and it's that's it inadvertently becomes an interesting commentary on the art world because, yeah, the price went up when it sort of came to light because this one museum bought one or this one auction house or something. And once it became, it's like a fashion thing. Once they did, and then everybody wanted to get it, and now it's worth more.
Can I ask you a question related to this?
Oh, did you tell us what episode it is?
Yeah.
Okay. What was it?
422.
All right. Just so you know, you have about 100% of the information I have on this, but go for it.
What?
I don't know any more details of the artist and.
It's a related question. All right. All
right.
Okay, so
related to shit in the can.
I've heard people debating about art.
Okay.
And there's a perspective out there which I'll just say up front that I find kind of baffling because I'm not even sure where anyway, I'll just say what it is. Where they would say a piece like this is not art.
Mm-hmm.
It's not art at all. Mm-hmm. So they're deciding what art is, and generally it's what you would expect, like Renaissance, you know, stuff that you learn in art appreciation class or whatever. But a lot of modern art that involves things like this or peeing in a jar and putting a crucifix in it or whatever is not real art.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where they draw the line, but from my perspective, it all seems like art. I mean, I might have a different appreciation of it depending, but do you have a sense that there you can draw a line between what's quote unquote real art and what's not?
No, to me, art is like love and pornography. We talk about them a ton, but nobody can actually define them.
But they know them when they see them.
That exactly that bullshit.
Yeah.
And this is the thing, because like some of the things we acknowledge that, and I feel like the art debate has that. People are like, this is very subjective. You can't. But meanwhile. We very seldom discuss the context-specific subjectivity of the concept of love. If I say I love someone, and I know you said the sociological definitions of relationship or whatever. No. Like, we don't have a clear definition of that, and everybody thinks it's different. And people are constantly saying, that's such and such aspect of this relationship is part of what love is.
Yeah.
What? Maybe. I mean, and don't get me wrong. I'm fine with us not having a solid definition. I just get annoyed that we constantly talk as though we do. And you get that to a degree with the art stuff. There are certain processes you can... I mean, like, they've tried this by and large with genuine, well-educated art critics. You can show them, you know, abstract art by somebody who has studied but is unknown, or you can show them a four-year-old's finger painting, and they can tell the difference. Mm-hmm. There are specific things involved.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean one is art and one isn't.
Well, but this thing with the can, I mean, that's about as esoteric as you can get, because the value in this piece is in what is done with it, right? Like the whole thing you're talking about where nobody wants to open it for a variety of reasons. You see what I'm saying? It's
Well, and it also overlaps heavily with the concept of a collectible, which is a different thing than art. I'm not saying they can't be both.
Yeah.
But that becomes a different thing. And then that becomes about fame and rarity as well.
But in this case, what I'm getting at is there's not a lot of, and this is one of the arguments that they put forth by trying to differentiate between what's art and what's not, is they'll say, well, this, someone had to have some skill and craft and whatever else. And of course, with a can and defecating in a can, there's no real craft involved there. Although there is creativity, obviously.
I think there's too many examples you can hold up of people who did not have skill and still created something artistic. I mean, there's whole schools of art.
Right, sure.
Or outsider art is absolutely that. Various aspects of folk art can fall into that category. There's a lot of skill in folk art, too, but some not.
No, I agree.
And also, some of this, there's some expressionist art out there that, to me, took no skill. How much effort did most of Christo's shit take? It took money. It took manpower. But how much, you know what, we're going to put pink umbrellas in this one spot and then pink umbrellas in a different spot. I mean, and I'm not saying it's not art. I'm just saying, other than the fact that it costs more to do, how is that different from shitting in a can? Well,
sure. Now, why do you think people feel the need to... I mean, I guess that's a bigger question for me is, why even think about where to draw the line between what's art and what's not art? What's the motivation behind...
Oh, it's ego-driven. It's entirely ego-driven.
But how does it serve a person's ego to decide where that line
because
is?
Because if I look at something and I'm like, that's just dumb. It's the same thing as that's not music, that's noise.
Mm.
If I cannot find appreciation in it, to me either, that means it is not something that can be appreciated by the rules of art or music, or my vision for such things is too narrow and people don't want to believe the second one. And I get caught in small versions of that all the time, where if there's something I like, I try and I consciously am like, it's just not my thing. But there's definitely times where I'm like, whatever. I mean, like, you know, on a political level, the jar of pee with the cross in it, it's important. Be recognized as art is just as valuable as anything else. Because it's offensive does not inherently change it. I'm also like, Jesus fucking Christ, dude, that's dumb as shit, as pee in this, like, whatever. On a very personal level. And it's very hard for me to translate and be like, my personal feelings are this, but also... it's still art. It's just not art. Because then it seems like a failing of mine. Like, that I can't appreciate it. If it's art and I can't appreciate it, it sucks that there's art that I can't appreciate.
Okay,
so
but
it'd be way easier if I'm like, it's just not art.
Sure. But isn't it... when you look at it and you think, come on, dude, this is stupid, isn't that a kind of appreciation? You're responding to it, and that's what art's supposed to do.
Well, there's a lot of shit that nobody intended to be art that I say, come on, that's stupid. I mean, by that token, literally everything is art all the time.
I mean, if
you define art as something that elicits an opinion from me about it,
that someone made so that it would elicit a response specifically for that purpose.
That's potentially an argument there.
I mean,
made to evoke an emotion.
Yeah, the worst thing, a piece of, I mean, if someone's making a piece of art, any piece of art that I can think of, and a person doesn't have a response to it at all or is an indifferent response, that's the worst. It's better if they were angry or hated it.
But there's definitely a school of thought there. There's a school of thought that says, no, it's not the jar of pee that's not art. It's the generic sailboat that they hang in the motel room that's not art. Because it's boring and generic and nobody cares about it. So you run into the same trap for different reasons. But again, then judging it because you're like, no, it should have... And that's, again, you trying to nail down the definition of art.
No. I'm just saying if you're an artist, you want people to respond to the thing. If they don't respond to it, it's still art. It's just art that has kind of failed to do what you wanted it to do, right?
Well, yeah, and when I consider my appreciation of art, I don't consider whether or not the artist is happy with what. Why would I?
I understand what you're saying. I just think
I think P-Jar guy is probably really proud of himself. I know a lot of people that have put things in jars of urine that they're proud of.
My response to a lot of art is not to love it or hate it, but is to be baffled by it. And so that's when I feel like I'm not appreciating it. I'm just because I'm not connecting with it at all. And it's probably me, because if it's hanging in a gallery or something, there's probably some value to it that I just don't get.
You have much more capacity than anyone I know, pretty much, to embrace your own lacking and to be cool with that. Clearly, I am not enough for this piece of art.
Well,
most people like to... I mean, even if they consciously want to be that way, they're like, no, it's not me. It's that it's dumb.
But it doesn't... What there's so much art, you know, it's, you don't have to feel like you have to get it all, right?
No, but there's so much art, we totally want to start going like, this is good, this is bad. Anything, there's a lot of. I mean, it's not a far step from, because people are like, okay, take music. I get this music. It speaks to me. Mm-hmm. I love it. Mm-hmm. This sounds stupid and just like noise, and I don't even get why it's there. So we start with that. We start with, I connect with this. I don't connect with this.
Sure, right.
It is a very small jump, and I'm not saying it's a fair one, but it's a very small jump to, this is good music,
I think.
This is shitty music, right. I think.
Sure.
And then the extreme version of that is this, is like the platonic ideal of music. This isn't even music.
Well, now, so let me explain the other argument I've heard about the separation. You're saying it's kind of an ego thing and people want to feel like what they like is good, whatever, and what they don't like is bad, maybe. But the argument goes further to say that when you draw this line, the stuff on the good side is a celebration of culture, Western culture mostly, and on the other side is a front to Western culture, and that's how they're distinguishing it.
Well, and that's where you get into frequently obscenity and things like that. This thing symbolizes all the stuff I like.
Yeah, right.
This thing symbolizes, to pick a concept out of the air at random, all the shit the young people are into that I consider stupid and obscene and what's wrong with this country nowadays.
Yeah.
It's very easy. Personal opinion turns into universal opinion, turns into literal definitions of the world. That's how hegemony works.
I guess it always surprises me and baffles me a little bit when I run into a situation where a person seems to want to take an opinion, but assert it like it's a fact.
Yep.
I don't understand that.
I'm not a huge fan of Dave Barry, the columnist and humorist.
Yeah.
He's got some issues. Weirdly, I watched the sitcom that was based off of his life quite a lot. because I loved Harry.
Harry Anderson, yeah. He was in that.
And in fact, I think I watched it for years before I realized that's who it was supposed to be.
Oh.
But one thing that is just such a touchstone to me, and I think it explains all this, almost everyone believes they are an above average driver.
Yeah, I guess.
Almost everyone believes they basically fall into a normal range of things. That they understand the basic human thing. The things I like are not shitty things and I'm broken. The things I find offensive aren't perfectly nice things that I just have a stick up my butt about.
Sure.
The things that I like aren't bizarre fetishes that I just have a thing for.
But
these are the good things.
All of those things you're saying, though, a lot of assumptions go with you being able to make statements like that.
Oh, without a doubt.
The biggest assumption being that the things you like or don't like are somehow not a matter of opinion. I mean, if you acknowledge that they're a matter of opinion, it doesn't really matter if they're quote-unquote good or bad or...
Except here's the thing. There's a beautiful version of opinion that might as well be fact. It's called common sense.
Hmm.
Common sense is a thing where I say, this is my opinion, but guess what? It's also the opinion of all the normal people.
All the normal people.
All the good people. All the people who have really thought about it, who have used sense. So it might as well be a fact.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm an above average driver. And you do get the people, they're usually teenagers, who don't think they're normal, who think they're weird, who think they're fringe. And it can cause a lot of alienation. It can cause a lot of fucking suicide. But the common defense for that one that I have used myself, and arguably still use to this day, is I get it. All you sheeple don't understand, but I'm the one who knows that art, that music, those politics are bullshit. I am one of the few who sees the truth
over here.
That Skrillex really is a god. Probably a bad example. He's quite popular, but you see what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
That's
interesting.
And that's the thing. People don't want to go through their life thinking they're wrong about anything. And people are obsessed with right versus wrong. People aren't okay with is.
I mean,
good, bad, right, wrong, black, white, forward, backward.
That's a cultural thing, though, right?
I don't know. I feel like there's a deeply ingrained... And there are some evolutionary arguments for the need for categorization and things like that. And the simplest categorization is duality. On, off, right, wrong.
Yeah, but it's... that is the simplest, but it's also pretty much the most useless.
Agreed.
Well, then that's not going to be an evolutionary benefit to be dualistic like that.
That's a good point.
So...
I don't know.
I mean...
Maybe it is cultural. I think it's pretty broad cultural, because I don't think this is a particular thing that the West has over the East, necessarily.
Well, I
think people get... I think the basis for a lot of religion is based on right and wrong. Right? That just the very idea. We consider it a very fundamental thing. You have to teach children right from wrong.
Yeah, but when I was raised, right from wrong... I mean, it doesn't, what you're talking about doesn't sound like the way I was raised as far as understanding about right and wrong and how it works in a person's life. I mean, I remember being taught the difference between a fact and opinion and that opinions are okay, but, you know, the biggest mistake you can make is to insist that an opinion is a fact, because then you're a fanatic, and being a fanatic is not a good thing. Right and wrong is not an easy thing to parse out, and you shouldn't judge other people. You know, it might seem obvious on the surface that what they're doing is good or bad or right or wrong, but you don't know. You're not in their position. You're not in their place. So, I mean, I think a lot of lessons that people learn when they grow up kind of counter
uh,
contradict what you're describing.
I would amend what you said slightly. A lot of lessons that people are told. Not necessarily a lot of lessons that people learn.
Well, okay, but as we've talked about before, it seems like one of the things I noticed about my upbringing is it seemed to really not focus on status or understanding status or having status work.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of what you're saying exists mostly in a world where status is a big thing.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a cultural thing. That's status
yes,
isn't.
Yes, but again, it's a very broad cultural thing. It's not a specific Western thing.
That's true.
Status is a thing. In a lot of, in most extinct
right, but
cultures.
I wonder though if, because from what I can tell, from the things I've read and studied on this topic, if status was not the kind of thing before, say, 10,000 years ago that it became when you had things like empires and things like that, you know, mm-hmm. Very strict, hierarchical. I mean, it seems like you've always had, chiefs and tribes and hierarchies and things, but there's a spectrum of them being very strict and having a lot of taboos and stuff associated with them, or very loose.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's anthropology is very clear. You've got some tribes. Yeah, you've got someone who's in charge, but they're not really bossing everybody around or lording it over everybody. And so in the harsher ones, you might have that status thing, but in the more open egalitarian ones, status doesn't seem to be a really significant
thing. No, but it's absolutely something that could evolve, I say, not in a biological sense of evolution, but I'm in a tribe or whatever. Status is just an abstract economic symbol, basically, because status at its heart only means one thing. I am, for whatever reason, more deserving of resources.
Right.
And so if you invent that, that's awesome for you. And other people, if they see that and figure out that's what's happening, then they want to do that. And that's what status becomes. And so it's a way to gather resources that is not egalitarian and not necessarily more efficient than egalitarian, but it's absolutely an effective social niche.
Yeah, I can see that, definitely.
Now, it can go in waves, and like I've talked about before, I'm really hoping that the world of the social media influencer is having a bubble that's going to burst soon, because everybody's getting really tired of this idea. I'm so famous, you should give me things, because people just knowing I have your things will make your things do well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just another, it's like when you look at, I hate doing this because I'm so big on social Darwinism is not a thing, but essentially it's looking at the way the polity runs the same way you would look at an ecological niche in an evolutionary sense. There are different ones which are hugely different from each other, but they worked in a particular ecology where that flourished.
Right. Well, that's why I say in the last 10,000 years, when you have things like cities and empires, the status of the kind that we're talking about and that we're familiar with in our culture starts to become something that really works.
Yes.
But it's not sustainable either. I mean, that's why empires fall, yes. And that's why we have all these problems.
I would venture it's probably also tied into increased ego boundaries. Because if my identity is tribal, I just want my people to succeed. If my identity is individual, I want me to succeed.
Sure.
And I'm willing to screw over the tribe, at least in small ways, by saying, I'm clearly the most important in the tribe, so I should have more.
And again, that's something that you can imagine happening for all of human history, but
this is something I've been thinking about just yesterday.
More so recently, though, right? Like,
yes.
Since the Enlightenment.
Well,
and it
expands. Class distinction makes it worse, because I've been thinking about this recently. Part of the perpetuation of the successful perpetuation of the rich get richer and the poor get poorer is, I think, for the most part, in our society, the rich are encouraged not to identify as individuals, but to identify as families. So you are not trying to make yourself the best success possible. You are trying to make your family successful. You're trying to have a legacy.
Literal dynasties.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you do shit that you don't even necessarily agree with, but you have to do it for the good of the family.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And consequently, the family continues to be successful. And you can have one asshole in a generation. I mean, they're all assholes in their own special way. There's issues of entitlement and all that. Sure. But, I mean, you can have one that does terrible shit, and as long as you cover it right. But you can't, if you destroy the chain, if you break a link in the chain, the family falls apart. And that's why you get all these legacies, all these dynasties, all these, the rich getting richer because they inherit, and because the next generation isn't like, you know what? I'm just going to blow all this money, or I'm going to use this money for charity. No, it's always to make more money, to gain more status, to gain more influence.
Sure.
And so on. And the poor have a lot less of that model. And again, these are not absolutes, of course.
Sure, right.
But the poor have a much more individual model. There is much more. I mean, you know, you have your loving bonds and everything, but it's mostly, what am I going to make for myself? What? I'm not expecting a lot from my parents in terms of inheritance or anything, so I have to go and make an individual contribution to society. But that's frequently something that's hard to pass on. This was just something I was pondering last night. That was weird. For those of you just joining us, we're almost done. most of what you heard wasn't the show. We have a hat. It's magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks like people like you write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. With little notes, comments, questions, topics, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. It's extremely talkative servants draw the note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, do that for about an hour. That's the whole show, except the parts that aren't, which is most of it. And we've been gone for 2 weeks. So,
yeah,
we mostly had to talk about shit in a can. Also art.
In class, it's kind of an interesting, I'm still thinking about what you just said.
I mean, there's a lot of me playing with, lately I've really been looking into cultural linguistics.
Yeah.
And the whole idea of culture. There is a general consensus in the anthropology world that culture comes from language. That you don't have culture until you have language. And language essentially comes about from being able to do abstract thought and the concept of something as a symbol.
Yeah.
Yeah,
sociologists say that too.
And it, the thing is, it builds from there. Every strata to society as we see it now is basically an abstraction of something into a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get beyond basic subsistence, it's symbols all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been really fascinated thinking about this lately. Like, yeah. Why are these symbols like this? And the funny thing is, they all feel so superfluous because of, like, we've created a lot of cool stuff in society, but like, it all feels so intensely unnecessary. But of course, some of the symbols are able to manage scale. Sometimes it's just in a straightforward economic sense, and sometimes in a psychological sense. I mean, there's a lot of layers and symbols we have to put in just so we don't go insane looking at the inequality in the world and things like that. Rationalizations and all, but yeah, so I've been thinking about a lot of that shit. But we've been gone for 2 weeks. We should talk about that because we're running out of time. And you saw Schism, the story of a kid who can turn into Jim Neighbors, wasn't it? Something like that.
No,
I don't remember. How was Schism?
The conversations we've been having so far are more interesting than talking about Shazam. But we liked it.
People, fine. call here for listen here for movie reviews.
We liked it. We liked it. My wife liked it a lot. I felt sort
of. It's been happening lately with a lot of things. Your wife likes it slightly more than you do.
Well, I mean, right. But like with Game of Thrones, for example, she's just a huge Emilia Clarke fan. That's what's going on there. And I like Emilia Clarke too, but not enough to watch Game of Thrones unless I'm watching with my wife. No, in this case, it's kind of like how I felt about Wonder Woman. I wasn't sure. I kind of had to see Wonder Woman a second time to really know how I felt about it. In fact, we thought we'd see it a second time before today, so I could kind of really get a sense of what I thought of it. But she just liked it straight off. She liked it right away. If anyone's interested in, you know, a comic book movie or decent comic movie, I'd recommend going to see it. I think to compare it to the MCU, I think it's basically Ant-Man. It's DC's Ant-Man.
That was the vibe I was getting to.
Yeah.
Weirdly, from the box office, it's right about Ant-Man.
Yep. The money it's making. I think the critics might like it a little bit more. I don't know how Ant-Man did in Rotten Tomatoes.
I think I don't remember either.
Because Shazam's at like 91%.
Most of the MCUs, I basically don't even look. So I'm going to go see it.
Yeah, Shazam's at like 91%. So
I think it's another one of those. It's nice to have something nice for a change.
Well, maybe.
It's nice that everything's not dark and fucked up all the time.
The reason I was a little worried that I wouldn't, because I'm actually a fan of.
Yeah, you're a bit into the
Captain Marvel is who he was when I was a kid, but he's just Shazam now because of the other Captain Marvel. And one of the things that I like about this character, Shazam, is each letter of his name stands for one of his powers. Mm. And the S stands for the wisdom of Solomon. Mm. Okay. And I like that because it's a tricky thing to do because people who write Shazam stories are like, okay, so what is it like when he has the wisdom of Solomon, and when he turns back to Billy and he no longer has speed or strength, or does he also lose the wisdom of Solomon? And how does that work?
Isn't the wisdom of Solomon just knowing that the answer to every problem is to threaten to cut his head in half?
Well, but you see what I'm saying? It's kind of of all the powers, it's kind of an interesting power to write when you're writing a character. And a lot of writers have done interesting things with it. And when I first heard the pitch of, well, this is going to be big, but a superhero movie, and everyone was talking about how brilliant that was, my response to that was, that's not brilliant, that's stupid. And what are you going to do with the wisdom of Solomon bit? And all of the previews seem to indicate, yeah, that's just going
to
be gone.
Yeah, no, he definitely seemed to have the wisdom of a small child.
Yeah, that's just going to be out. Now, it's not that I mind Shazam having a childish exuberance or whatever. Yeah. In fact, I love that. I love I love someone telling a story where wisdom that we typically, and I think quite cynically, equate with
age
and cynicism being coupled with a child, because our culture wants you to think those two things don't go together, but Shazam shows you that actually they do. And that's what I like about it. But I thought, they're just going to get rid of that. And so the movie will be not as good as I would think. They kept the wisdom of Solomon. I'm just throwing that out there because it's right at the very beginning. So you might be wondering, so why did I see all that stuff in the preview where he didn't seem very wise? Well, notice also you saw in the preview that he couldn't fly right away.
Yeah.
So that's what it is.
He had to learn his wisdom.
Yeah, his powers come sort of gradually. Now, I find that kind of interesting. I saw some people criticizing it because you also saw in the preview that the villain had some of similar powers, and he didn't take him any time at all to learn how to do stuff. And so people are like, what's going on there? Well, there is a narrative explanation for it, but I'm not surprised that some people missed it.
Sith always get their powers faster.
No. I won't say what it is, but if you see the movie, you'll see there is a narrative explanation for it. It's actually quite clever, but it's also pretty subtle, so maybe people didn't notice it. And The wisdom sort of does kick in eventually, and it's very satisfying when it does, but that doesn't hit you over the head either. So I've seen critics say, you know, this, the beginning said he had the wisdom of Solomon, but he didn't show any of it. But again, if you're paying attention, yeah, it finally does kick in, and it's actually very interesting and satisfying when it does. So I'm kind of surprised some critics missed it. But I don't know. I'd like to see it again to really get a sense of what I think of it, but my wife liked it straight
up. Well,
off.
We've got it here now. No, I don't.
I mean, I could talk about other things, but like you said, we're running out of time. You've probably got a lot to talk about for your 2 weeks.
Not too much. I'm writing again.
Well, that's good.
The last few days, I've been holding back a little bit. I'm about to tackle the first chapter, that is the fight scene in the City of Giants.
Mm.
And I'm getting anxious because a lot of people had legitimately a lot of issues with it. Like they didn't like the scene, but just like this wording is weird.
Okay.
You especially, you had a ton of shit.
Oh, did I?
Yours was very specific language things. Like not almost copy editing, but not quite.
Mm.
You have a very specific linguistic style. I noticed this. There were a lot of places in your edits that I was like, he's just sort of making my book sound like his. And those are the things that I'm like, yeah, I love you, Will. I'm ignoring that.
No, yeah, right.
And don't get me wrong,
there's
plenty of other useful stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of ones where you're like, take out this word. And I'm like, you absolutely don't have to take out that word. Like, that's not a grammar thing or whatever.
I totally understand.
And also, to be fair, there are times where you're like, you should say it like this, and I'm like, yeah, that is actually way better. Like, you have some of those, too. But it's mostly just making it sound more like your books, and sometimes that's good, sometimes that's not. But you had a bunch, but other people had a bunch. It's busy. It's a fight scene and stuff. The logistics are crazy. A lot of, like, underlying plot elements are in there that I have to be, like, not over the head with, but they still have to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly it's a very complicated scene.
Yeah.
And it's a very important scene. And so, yeah, so I'm having anxiety about actually, okay, let's sit down and write this. So I have been dragging my feet the last few
days. All I remember about it is it was very vivid and powerful and important. That's what I remember about
it. And the thing is, also going back now, I'm like, there's a lot more. I mean, it's a major plot point where things turn.
Right.
But there's a bunch of stuff. Like, I have to emphasize, like, sympathy with certain characters, stakes involved.
Yes,
things
right.
like that.
Right.
That are now much more clear to me that, like, I have to get this in here and I haven't necessarily. And so the whole thing is just intimidating. So I've been dragging my feet on that scene. But I need to do it. We'll see. Last weekend, tried to go see my niece in her play. Didn't so much pull that off.
Oh.
We drive to go do that. It's about 2.5 hours away. It's in Peoria, basically. We ran over a screw. Got a leak in the tire. Ended up by the side of the road. About halfway there.
Oh, no.
So.
Did you have a spare and stuff?
We had a donut.
Mm-hmm.
But we also couldn't effectively get the other one off. But we have roadside assistance.
Okay.
So we call them. So great, right? No, here's the thing. Mechanics open Monday through Friday. Almost all of them open till noon. Saturday. This was like 10 minutes after 12. So they couldn't find him. And finally, for somebody from pretty far away, enough that we had to pay some money to do it. But then put the donut back on, and we're like, we're not going to make the play now. We're going to go home. 80 miles on the donut.
Boy.
Yeah. 50 miles an hour the whole way.
Yeah, right.
On the interstate.
Right.
We were pissing off people left and right.
Right.
And I'm like, we're above the minimum. Shut up. So that was not fun either. And then also, now it's fixed, but puncture was just enough on the side it can't be patched. Need a new tire. You don't buy tires as ones.
Not usually.
Yes, you need to buy it. So $800 later,
boy,
we're all good.
And you missed the play.
And we missed the play. Tiny, tiny upshot.
Okay.
Didn't realize play, which is kids' play, it's all teenagers and children and stuff,
was really racist.
No, 2.5 fucking hours long.
Oh. Wait, you're gonna see
You're gonna there's a silver lining.
You're going to see a Marvel movie that's 2.5 hours long.
That's 3 hours long. And believe me, I'm not happy about that. Trish sent me an article that was like, the argument for an intermission in Endgame. And I'm like, the argument is, what the fuck is the counter argument? There is none. Of course have an intermission in a 3 hour movie. And don't get me wrong, I know you're not going to, assholes, but there's literally no reason why you should not.
That's right.
I want to say when we saw Lincoln in the theater that they actually had one. And that was like three and a half hours.
I didn't see it in the theater.
I feel like there was.
Oh, that would have been awesome.
Yeah, I feel like there was. And I feel like I was surprised by it at the time.
They used to do it all the time.
Back in the day when it didn't. Yeah, it was also back in the day when 2.5, 3 hour movies weren't the norm.
Yeah.
So I remember being surprised, but it was nice. Yeah. And this one just means the day I go see it, I can't drink any fluids.
Yeah, right.
From when I wake up till the 3:30 showing.
Why did they get rid of intermissions in films? Just because they're kick guys? I mean, films weren't especially long when they did that.
I have no idea.
It seems like you would put intermissions in to make more money at the concessions, right? Because people would go buy more stuff.
Makes sense to me. The other thing, and unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time. So
sorry.
We might not get questioned. We're getting bad about this. Last night, watched, Trish and I watched, The Favorite.
What is that?
It's a retelling.
Oh, the Queen. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet.
Rachel Weisz.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
Emma Stone. I was very excited for it. I love Olivia Colman.
Yeah, love her to death. Me too. Didn't she win a Oscar?
I think she won Best Actress for it.
Yeah.
I am warming up to Rachel Weisz. I've never disliked her.
Okay.
But she just is often in things that I'm not that into.
Okay.
But I'm starting to see she's got some chops.
Yeah, she's good.
And Emma Stone nails it.
Yeah, right.
In everything she does.
She really does.
So I was very excited about this.
Yeah.
And it looked funny and all this stuff. It's weird.
Yeah, I've heard that.
I had not.
Oh, okay.
It is weird.
Like in a way you didn't like?
I'm not going to say that. That's the thing. I'm having a really hard time saying if it's good or bad.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The closest thing I could think of at the time is it's very Baz Luhrmann-y.
Mm.
It's very surreal. It's not just like a historical drama.
Mm.
But, I mean, it is a historical drama. But it just has a weirdness. And it's filmed in very strange ways. There is a tremendous amount. So those are the three main characters.
Mm-hmm.
Each of them gets at least two, and I think more in some cases, shots that are just shots of that person's face for like minimum 30 seconds.
Wow.
And not still frame and not like while conversation is happening, like just music, their face, 30 seconds, happens throughout the film.
Huh.
And on a certain level, it is fascinating because they really play it well because they're frequently scenes where there's a lot of shit going on through their head and they're expressing it in their face. So in some ways, it's kind of cool that way. But there's just a lot of weirdness to it. It's very odd.
Does anyone eat pie for 5 minutes? Does anyone do that?
No, there's no Rooney Mara pie. Although, there is the shittiest music cue ever that almost drove Trish out of the room. That was absolutely like something out of a goddamn ghost story.
Oh.
There's this thing that they do that starts very softly and then builds over the course of like 10 minutes. And all it is somebody hitting a note on a piano, dink, immediately followed by somebody barely scraping a bow across a violin for like an inch. Just, dink, 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 for, in one case, it went through like three scenes just building. And then, like, oh my God, and finally it stopped. And then, like, a half hour later, they start doing it again. And Trish is like, no! And the thing is, it is absolutely an effective musical device for, like, a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I'm gonna kill you. Like, there's so many, and that's the thing. It is gorgeous. It is brilliantly acted. Somebody was just a little high while they were making... It's just, like I said, Baz Luhrmann-y. It just very much reminds me of somebody just, he showed up one day and just did an overview and was like, no, that dancing should be crazier. Yeah, let's focus on this for a while. Strings, I need strings. All right. Like,
just gave a lot of notes.
Exactly.
And then they just did it.
And then it was, you know, it's bizarre, but it's sticking with me, not just for its weirdness, but like the story. So I think that's a good sign.
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about it. So it's interesting on that level. Yeah, so I can't say good or bad. I mean, I think it's worth seeing as a curiosity, if nothing else. And it's definitely not a bad film.
I mean, we'll probably
see it. But I wouldn't
go
so far as to say it's a good film.
Yeah, we'll probably see it.
I find it amazing that people keep mixing it up with Mary Queen of Scots. Admittedly, I still haven't seen Mary Queen of Scots. But from what I hear, that's a much more straight-up
historical yeah.
drama.
Yeah.
So that was weird. I don't know. We're going to shortchange somebody with this question, but let's give it a shot.
Did you watch The Twilight Zone?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, shit. All right. Yeah, no, you're screwed. We got no questions today.
You want to talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Did you watch it?
Yeah.
That's right.
It was great. I thought it was great.
I think it is great. So just so people are aware. So Twilight Zone's back. Jordan Peele's doing it. He's doing it on CBS All Access. God damn it.
I know.
I think CBS still owns the rights as part of it. But whatever. The first episode is on YouTube.
Yeah.
You can watch it in its completeness there.
And you should watch it.
And the lead in it is Kumail Nanjiani, who I talk about a lot mm-hmm. and who I'm a very big fan of. And he plays a stand-up comedian in it, yeah. which is extra fun. No, it was very cool. It was very Twilight Zone.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And that was the fun thing, because I was talking to someone, and they're like, are there any jump scares? I'm like, no. It's like, I wouldn't even say it's scary, except like in an existential
yeah,
way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's great for that. I am fascinated by what Jordan Peele is doing as the narrator.
Yeah.
Because here's the thing. If you watch The Twilight Zone now, it's a little campy entirely because of age. Like, it was
mostly,
dead
yeah.
serious, but yeah. now it feels almost like a parody of itself. And so it's really hard to tell, because Jordan Peele is doing a straight-up humorless Rod Serling impression.
It's good.
That almost makes you laugh. That's the thing. It's like, it's super serious. So I almost feel like it's a joke, but I'm pretty sure it's not. And that's just weird. I mean, in a cool way, but it's very weird. I'm like, I feel like I should be chuckling a little bit. but no, very, like, he's just sticking to it. He is committing to that.
The thing is, you can watch on Netflix streaming, or until recently, you could watch all the Twilight Zones. My wife and I did. We only finished them a few months ago.
I think now they're on Prime, because I think when I was trying to... Because people also said it was free on Prime, and that is bullshit.
Well, it was,
there yeah. you can do the free trial of CBS All Access and watch it. But
no, I mean the old Twilight Zones.
Yeah, yeah, no, and that's what I'm saying. When I was looking for it, I first was looking for it on Amazon.
Oh.
And in the process, it was throwing all the old ones at me, and yeah. I think those were Prime ones. So I think it may have jumped there recently.
So we just finished watching like all of them over the course of several months, maybe all of last year. And so we kind of have our brains programmed to
yep.
that, and it's like, this is like watching
yeah, no,
an
absolutely.
Old Twilight,
absolutely.
Except better, of course. I mean, like you said,
the effects are better, the yeah, acting's better.
Well, and even some of the stories don't age very well, you know, because they're science fiction-y and they're things
yeah.
like, we know more about science now kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So this definitely fit, but it was modernized and it was you know, more slickly produced. And I thought, because here's the thing, they tried to revive Twilight Zone before.
It was hideous.
Yeah, it was terrible. Forrest
Whitaker.
Because
it was the 90s. They were also doing all these weird horror anthologies at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just felt like that. No, it was a mess.
And Forrest Whitaker was the narrator, and I like Forrest Whitaker, but it just didn't work.
Yeah.
But this was like, I couldn't believe. It was like, this yeah. is Twilight Zone. I mean, Jordan Peele is really doing it.
I liked it. I don't think I liked it as much as some other people were, for very specific reasons to me that are my problem, not it. And there's two of them. I am too close to two things in this. One is Kumail. Because this is the first time. I mean, Big Sick, he was brilliant. He was literally playing himself.
Yeah.
This character was not Kumail.
Mm.
Which you know, is good. He's an actor.
Yeah, right, right.
But it felt weird to me because he wasn't acting like himself. Speaking of which, he's going to be in a buddy cop thing with Dave Bautista called Stuber.
What?
That looks insane. He's an Uber driver and Dave Bautista's like a rogue cop and they go, and it's a comedy and they go around doing business.
Okay.
Trish showed me the thing. Looks insane. It's either going to suck or be amazing.
Yeah, one of those two things.
But anyway, but so there was a lot of things for me that I'm like, why is Kumail acting this way? Because to me, he's Kumail.
Yeah, right.
Which is something I just have to get over, especially as he acts more.
That's hilarious.
And the other thing is, some of the stand-up stuff didn't work. And some of the stand-up stuff didn't work because it couldn't work because we were in the Twilight Zone and the premise
and stuff like that. Right.
But there were so many times that I'm just like, that's not how stand-up is.
Yeah, right, right.
And you're doing, and like, he's legit a shitty stand-up. And I'm like, I know you are better than this. And there was just a lot of, and don't get me wrong, in a lot of ways, they nailed a lot of the stand-up aspects.
Yeah.
And a lot of what I understand about the comedian's mind and things like that from all the stuff I've watched. But it made for this uncanny valley thing. So the things that didn't work were jarring to me. But again, I think that's too close to the subject. And it just 100% was a Twilight Zone.
What about Tracy Jordan, though?
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful.
Yeah, wasn't that amazing?
Beautiful.
I thought, wow, I have never seen him play a part like that.
And just right, because a little Tracy Jordan goes a long
way.
And basically he would have started satirizing himself if he'd had too big of a part.
Yeah.
And he was really good. And she, the other comic.
Yeah, who was that?
I don't know, but she was great. Loved her.
Do you think she's really a comic too, or?
I don't know anything about her.
She I don't
was
either.
Really
she
good.
Was, she her was good.
Her routine was fine, but it's totally something you could just write
yeah,
and have somebody
right.
do.
Yeah, yeah.
But she had an intensity I really liked. The nephew was very believable. I liked the girlfriend fine. It was not a revolutionary role.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, it's
but
Twilight
she did
Zone,
great
so.
With it. Weirded me out, though, the guy who plays her mentor or whatever. I thought I recognized the actor, and I look him up, and it's not the actor I thought it was. It's a different actor that I know from an old Canadian sci-fi show called Sanctuary. And I was like, holy crap, because I apparently haven't seen him in like a decade. He looks way different now. So that was fun.
I recognized him too, but from something else.
Yeah, I don't... Yeah, I in Sanctuary, he was the werewolf guy, but
I love Twilight Zone, Rod Serling's Twilight Zone. I've always been a pretty big fan of it. There were lots that I hadn't seen, so when it was on Netflix, I loved that we were able to watch them all.
Yeah.
And I was kind of surprised by how many I had seen, honestly. And it was great fun to watch them, but none of them have aged well. I mean, maybe a couple, like the one that William Shatner's in, where he's putting coins in the little machine with the devil head that gives...
Oh.
Gives...
I feel like I saw that one recently, because every once in a while sci-fi does a marathon.
That's still a good one. I mean, that holds up, but most of them don't.
A lot of the classic ones, like I...
Most of them don't.
I can't handle the Burgess Meredith one anymore.
But the thing is, it's still so fun for me to watch just because of the historical context.
Absolutely. That's why I watched the old, the British equivalent, Tales of the Unexpected. They're terrible, but it's fun to watch it as an artifact.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, there have been anthologies forever, in literature and then radio and then TV. So that wasn't anything new. But Rod Serling made you feel like, and usually the anthologies, they conform to like a genre or whatever, but the Twilight Zone didn't feel like it was just here's science fiction or here's horror.
No.
It felt like a curated thing. And it also felt like he was actually a guy taking you someplace.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And even the other things that had hosts, because a lot of them did have hosts, didn't make you feel like
that. Well, Andy became an archetype.
Yeah, yeah,
because
Because
after him, I mean, hell, Unsolved Mysteries wouldn't have existed. Like, Robert Stack would not... I mean, and no, defense, Robert Stack had an illustrious career before then. But the shit Robert Stack was doing in Unsolved Mysteries, he owes to Rod Serling.
Yeah, but there's just nothing like it before. I mean, there were anthologies.
No.
There were
agreed.
But this was what Rod Serling did was he made the anthology-ness of it a thing, like part of it, and it was curated with, there was science fiction in it, there was drama, there was everything in it, but it still was curated by some principle that you could barely grasp, but that but you knew Rod Serling got it.
Sort of early TV's so version cool. to cosmic horror. It was one of sort of the first attempts at that sort of existential
dread
on TV. I mean, we had it in literature.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's what's fun about it, because it's like, it's not horror, it's not sci-fi. It's sort of both of those.
Yeah. Or it can be on a spectrum.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
It's just amazing.
It's just sort of a cosmic horror. It's a, the universe is not as you think kind of thing.
But you just felt like you were going to a place. I mean,
the Twilight Zone.
The Twilight Zone is a real place, and you're seeing it. And that's what I liked about what Jordan Peele did, was he made me feel like that.
Yeah, definitely.
And I'm so impressed.
And you see what's going to be on the season. It looks really good.
Actually,
not enough to get that all access, but maybe eventually you can buy the season on Amazon or something.
And I like,
or when they finish the season, get the 7-day free trial, binge the shit out of it, and then cancel.
Yeah. It's going
to
be great, I think.
All right, we are super over time. Sorry we didn't get to any questions, guys. That's just how we roll. So actually, I feel really bad. We've been doing this a lot lately. We'll get better. But in the meantime, this is our friendship on tape, so who are you to interfere? Go about your business. But please keep listening.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.